The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski, and in this week's show, I'm joined by the crack team of Guardian technology journalistos, Samuel Gibbs.
Hello!
And Alex Hearn.
Yo!
Hey! That's a flashback for anybody previously listening to Tech Weekly. This week, we're embarking on a whole new slice of the technology coverage pie, carving the meat of the tech news world in such a way as to deliver to you a particularly filling sandwich. From now on in the podcast, we'll share analysis of the themes that cut across the day-to-day tech news that you read at theguardian.com/technology. So this week, get your little orphan Annie decoder rings at the ready. We're talking about encryption.
Do we want to allow a means of communication between people which even in extremis, with a signed warrant from the Home Secretary personally, that we cannot read?
Prime Minister David Cameron has always astonished the Guardian's tech team with his impressive grasp of technological things. From Web Cameron, which notably went the way of big society, in other words, shoved under the carpet, to announcing that social networks will be shut down during periods of unrest, he really does seem to be a man of the 21st century. His latest disunderstanding about the way the web works comes from the same place most government technological pronouncements originate: knee-jerk reactions and a culture of fear. So in the aftermath of the devastating attacks in Paris and on the blown-out-of-proportion hack into Sony Pictures by the North Koreans, Cameron flew to the US to offer his shoulder for President Barack Obama to lean on and to request that that government demand its tech companies allow the UK to break their encryption to keep us safe. Alex, what exactly are the details of Prime Minister David Cameron's plan for global encryption?
Well, you know, like a lot of David Cameron's technological pronouncements, the details were rather thin on the ground. Essentially, he seemed to be questioning whether or not it should be possible for us to have communications which couldn't be intercepted by the government. Who us is in that context, what intercepted by the government means.
Which government?
Just ours, all of them, anyone who wants. Those were all left slightly up in the air. But his complaint was similar in tone, if not in degree, to something that we've actually heard from the intelligence agencies a lot, which is that essentially old styles of communication, ranging from sending a letter to making a phone call, could in extremis be intercepted. And that there is a new breed of communication, essentially encrypted telecommunications, which can't be. And it's not harder, to the best of our understanding of the intelligence agency's ability. They cannot read, say, an email encrypted with PGP. It's simply not within their ability. And David Cameron was asking whether this should be possible, and this is what was left unsaid, was whether we should ban it or whether we should mandate it to have a back door which lets the government in, or in some other way make it so that the government could, you know, we could trust them to use that power only for good, but that they could look into the contents of bad guys' emails.
He specifically said, in extremis, it has been possible to read someone's letter, to listen to someone's call, to mobile communications. The question remains, are we going to allow a means of communications where it's simply not possible to do that? My answer to that question is no, we must not.
That was a really good impression, Sam.
Thank you.
Very, very good impression. Is it in fact possible to do that, or not possible? Is it a known unknown? In other words, unknown.
Well, it's basically you can't have your cake and eat it. Is essentially it. So, Cameron basically didn't spell out what he was proposing, and this might be here's a suggestion: run a mile for 2 years and see what happens. But it could also be he seriously is proposing that we either limit the level of encryption, so basically the level of complexity of the encryption means that GCHQ can't break it. at the highest level. But at lower levels, it has the computational power to actually decipher this stuff and do it on a case-by-case basis.
Can you just quickly go back to this idea of high and low? I don't understand what that distinction means, Alex.
I mean, so what we're talking is you can, when you encrypt something, you sign it with a key. And the key in that case isn't a physical lump of metal. It is a very, very long number. And those numbers are measured in the amount of bits in them. So you can have a 512-bit number or a 2096-bit number. Very simply, the longer the number, the stronger the encryption. It's one of those nice quirks of mathematics, which is that if you use a number which is twice as long, it takes you twice as long to encrypt something, but it takes someone four times as long to decrypt it. In other words, it gets more and more efficient, and it goes up at the, I believe it's at the square of the complexity. Like all encryption, it's easiest to discuss in maths, but essentially what Cameron's proposal was is it's something along the lines of saying it takes the police too long to knock down a steel door, so you have to have your front doors made out of wood.
Or cardboard.
You know,
that would be a 64-bit encryption.
Wood or softer, exactly. And obviously, you know, if that were the law, immediately people would start going, but I don't want to make my bank safe out of wood. I would quite like to make it out of steel. And this is part of the problem with what David Cameron was proposing.
I very much wish people like both of you, you know, were able to suggest how he should speak, because frankly, it seems to me that, you know, the smoke screens that are thrown up, if you pardon the sort of the pun, I suppose, the smoke screens that are thrown up around encryption, not very many people actually understand. You know, they hear it, they think it's slightly mysterious, they think it's going to solve all of their ills. But whether it's Cameron or whether it's Obama or whether it's, I don't know, me making some kind of pronouncement about encryption, most people don't actually understand it, do they? And so ultimately they could be talking about steel doors, or they could be talking about, I don't know, bubbles.
For me, I think the one big thing that was in David Cameron's announcement which suggests that he misses a crucial point about what encryption is that there's no trust involved in modern encryption technologies. When you send a letter through the post, you are essentially handing it to a trusted third party. You're handing it to, in the old days, Royal Mail. Royal Mail then says, you know, we will ensure that no one other than you and your recipient look at this. But that's our job. You have to trust Royal Mail to do that. And implicitly or explicitly, part of that trust is that Royal Mail will hand it over to the government if they ask. Similarly, wired phone connections. It's the same deal. You trust BT to essentially keep their wires intact to make sure that no one else plugs in halfway and listens to it. And again, BT can transfer some of that trust to the government. When you're talking about encryption technologies, or at least the type of strong encryption which so scares David Cameron, there is no trust. That, like a lot of things that happen online, that trust is mediated away by essentially extremely complicated maths.
But is it also not mediated away by the fact that it's not David Cameron or the government or, you know, the individual companies creating this encryption? Is it, you know, we don't have a BT anymore of the internet. We don't have a Royal Mail anymore of the internet. You know, so we have to kind of devolve our trust to a third party. And frankly, I don't know who that third party is. Somebody else has made that decision for me.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the best encryption specifically involves not releasing any trust to a third party. There are still systems which involve the use of a third party, and if we're looking far into the future, some elements of quantum computing which could break current encryption suggest that it might be easier to go back to that older way. But fundamentally, you're right, the problem is that there is a dearth of trusted middlemen on the internet. There's a lot of people who don't want to be in the middle of your communications, but especially if you're at all paranoid, there's very few people who you do. And so what encryption technology for the last 50 or so years has been about is trying to work out a way where you can act as though every single person in between you and your sender is not only not worth putting your trust in, but actively untrusted and still have a communication.
Samuel.
So, I mean, what we're talking about here and what Cameron's really worried about is end-to-end encryption, which effectively, as Alex says, when you send something, nobody can read it until it gets to the end. And, I mean, that in itself is a whole level of encryption that most people have to go to some lengths to use, or at least they did until recently. Now, the other type of encryption is basically what your I guess what your bank does, right? You encrypt your communications between you and the bank, okay? And at the point at which the bank has the information, then, for instance, if the government wanted that information, they could go to the bank and ask for that information. The same happens with, say, like email from Google, for instance. You encrypt between you and Google, but then at the point at which Google has it, it's then no longer encrypted in its transverse across the internet. I mean, it might be encrypted on its own servers, but Google has access to it, and therefore, if subpoenaed, for instance, could give information away. Now, the end-to-end means that I send something to Alex. There is nothing in between that can break that encryption, and Alex is not a company and therefore has no real, you know, leverage for the government to put over on him to actually get him to give up my message. Now, of course, you could go for the personal arrest, etc., etc., but, you know, one stage further is the self-destructing message. So imagine I send something to Alex. It is encrypted between me and Alex. Alex has 10 seconds to read it. After that, boom, gone.
I suppose that would be a way that we could get people to answer their emails more quickly. Yeah.
What did you say? Send it again.
Send it again. Then your computer starts to catch on fire. But surely, you know, if we are talking about this end-to-end issue, surely if we're talking about national security, right? This is the thing. This is the specter that continually waves over so much of this type of discussion as well. You know, we need to stop the bad guys or girls, but mostly the bad guys from communicating. We need to make sure that, you know, if they're doing it in Second Life, if they're doing it via Skype, if they're doing it by good old fashioned email or even ICQ, that we have access to this, right?
This is where I become the good company man and quote our own leader. And by that, I mean leader Colm, not referring to Alan Rusbridger in a slightly creepily devoted fashion. The thing is, this announcement was broadly in response to the attacks on Charlie Hebdo in Paris. The men who carried out those attacks were already known to the French intelligence agencies. The problem was that intelligence agencies are actively aware of a number of people, roughly in the thousands in a modern Western democracy. That's a lot of people, and it's tricky to keep tabs on that many people. But what removing encryption and performing mass surveillance does is it increases the number of people you have to keep your eye on, to millions. And as our leader put it, the Charlie Hebdo attacks were carried out by a couple of needles in a haystack, and David Cameron's solution is to dump bales of hay onto that haystack in an effort to what? Say, look, we've got a bigger haystack. We now know that there's more needles somewhere in there, but it doesn't really answer any of the questions that people were asking. Theoretically, what doing all of this does is it means that if someone is a lone wolf acting alone, or rather two people acting alone, because, of course, one lone wolf doesn't need to email anyone. Two lone
email
wolves
yourself.
Acting
I don't know,
in concert.
To-do lists and stuff.
Two lone wolves acting in concert, not part of any wider thing. That, maybe, you might be able to find them in a world where, you know, otherwise you wouldn't be looking at them. But that, then, you are back to conjuring up hypothetical terrorist scenarios to justify something which wouldn't have helped any previous ones because you want to go back to the good old days.
But theoretically, if this type of thing was passed and we had two lone wolves acting in concert with one another and sharing their emails back and forth, what actually is it that Cameron and Obama and other interested parties would like to gain access to? Is it email? Is it, you know, Skype communication? Is it Facebook chat? What is it?
It's all of the above, pretty much.
I mean, there's a list the mile long, though.
Absolutely. And, you know, The thing that gets me is that, yes, okay, you can ban encryption. Ban encryption for secure communications. Great. Okay. That makes it illegal to use it. Okay, great. These two lone wolves are about to try and kill somebody. They don't care whether they're being illegal or not. It's not going to stop it being produced. All it means is it'll stop consumers like you and I protecting ourselves with it. They'll just use whatever happens to be available, and there will be lots available. You can ban it in the UK, but the internet is global.
It's worth saying as well that the issue of banning encryption isn't hypothetical. It was already effectively tried in the 90s when PGP, which is still, and this shows how, you know, when we're talking about encryption, we're talking about mathematical proofs. PGP is still the gold standard for encrypting emails. It's not easy to use, and I think we'll talk about that later, but it works. And to the best of our knowledge, even after the Snowden leaks, no one has been able to break it. In the 90s, shortly after it was invented, the American government decided to treat it essentially as a weapon of war. It was military-grade encryption technology, and so it should be treated and subject to export controls like other military technology was, which led to the ridiculous situation of America trying to control the export of essentially a few lines of code. And hackers being hackers, once these controls were put in place, it became a game to try and get it out, to try and see what things they would subject to export controls. You had people who put functional implementations of PGP on t-shirts. You had one person who discovered a prime number very deliberately, which if you wrote it in binary and ran it as a program, would then execute something which could be used as a PGP program. And that prime number, being one of the longest prime numbers ever discovered, was printed into a book of long prime numbers, which was then theoretically, technically, subject to export controls. In other words, people took this, it was so absurd to try and enforce that people took it and made a game out of it, made a game out of seeing who they could induce to break these laws just by putting a few lines of code in some new fashion, some new way.
Well, to be honest, though, you know, as Jane Average here, right, I've got my computer and you know, I just, you know, send emails and I put pictures up on Tumblr and that's kind of all I do, right? I'm quite thankful that somebody's come along and said, I'm going to stop the terrorists by using this internet thing. And, you know, what David Cameron has said, you know, he seems to know what he's talking about, right? This I'm gonna do encryption stuff and technology gobbledygook, you know, thank goodness somebody is standing up for me. Is this a problem, Sam? Is my own personal ignorance about this a problem? Should I get more involved? Should I learn about encryption as a citizen of the United Kingdom?
Well, I think this is one of the things that we're going through at the moment. In the last 2 years, we've seen a switch from encryption having to be something that was basically something that a geek or somebody highly tech savvy would have to go through steps to do. Right. Now we are finding that the technology companies are working on user-friendly implementations of this thing. They're putting it in the background. It's transparent. The user doesn't have to even think about it. It just happens automatically. And at that point, it doesn't matter. But yes, this is where I guess grandstanding and making a speech about this and saying, oh yes, well, because it's because we need to keep you safe and we're protecting the country, it kind of bowls over. For instance, the technology experts, security experts, called David Cameron as living in cuckoo land over his ideas. Now, without that kind of commentator saying that kind of thing, it doesn't put it into perspective. You can't get an idea of it, and it's very easy to be pushed through. So yes, it is. I think it's a bit of a personal responsibility that people have to learn about these things, or at least have a vague understanding of what he's really talking about, what impact that could have on the individual people. And perhaps that's our job as the media.
David Cameron's playing a game to distract you. Encryption being spoken about in terms of, you know, communications between terrorists and encrypted emails and all things which people don't think apply to them lets him get away with the fact that what banning encryption also means is it means you suddenly it is impossible to access your online banking over Wi-Fi or on a mobile phone. Suddenly WhatsApp, which has encryption on by default, is illegal. WhatsApp, as an American company owned by Facebook, probably has no real desire to turn off a functionality which, in its very nature, is on or off for all of their customers. So it just means, hey, you can't use that in Britain. Tumblr, actually, you automatically access that over a secure connection. It's something that they turned on a few years back in the face of requests from privacy campaigners who pointed out that while you and I may just share fun pictures, some people share quite sensitive information on Tumblr and don't want someone to be able to intercept it to find out who they are and where they're posting it. So then what happens when you access Tumblr? Do they have to build a special front end just for England? It's one of those things, the devil is in the details, and David Cameron managed to focus on the sort of things which people don't think applies to them, while hoping that they won't look into the details enough to know that actually it really does.
Up next, we're going to hear from Eric King from Privacy International, who are trying to help inform policy in this area. But first, a word from our sponsor.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Okay, let's take a step back. Encryption is a word that's bandied around like other complicated concepts that everyone assumes you understand, like inflation or quantitative easing, and, you know, the web and the internet. But encryption isn't like the ciphers teenage detective Nancy Drew unpicked in my childhood mystery books. Or is it? Joining us from Privacy International is Eric King, who will guide us through the process. Eric, thank you very much for joining us. So please guide us through the process. Encryption, how is it done? Is it like my Nancy Drew ciphers?
It's not so far off. Encryption simply means a way of turning a message into a more secure form while it's being transmitted to prevent other parties from being able to gain access to it, and ensuring that only the person who's intended to receive it gets that message. Lots of things are built in around encryption. So alongside it, you do authentication as well, which makes sure that when you're speaking to someone, you're speaking to the right person. As a combination of these two things, our entire kind of modern communications infrastructure, you know, relies and is built on them. Removing encryption and removing authentication would almost stop our technological development in its tracks, particularly around kind of e-commerce, security for online banking transactions, and everything else. It really is the thing that makes the internet go around.
But it's not it isn't something that's necessarily brand new. I mentioned sort of slightly facetiously my Nancy Drew mystery books from when I was a child. But in Tom Standage's book, The Victorian Internet, he talks a lot about public codes. And he talks about how the very first public codes for that medium dated back to 1845. And, you know, by 1854, these are, of course, you know, I know these things in my head. No, I'm actually reading them. By 1854, 1 in 8 telegrams between New York and New Orleans was sent in code. So how much of the contemporary internet or the web encryption is based upon codes, philosophies, approaches that were developed for that particular technology?
Well, there was for a long time, encryption kind of followed the what's called kind of symmetrical encryption. And these are kind of some of the codes that you're referring to there. They're ones in which you have a way of enciphering a communication that's known to both parties. So one of the earliest examples of that would be ROT 13, which was developed by Julius Caesar. It's known as the Caesar cipher. And basically, it would take every letter in a word that you wanted to say, and it would move the letter forward 13 places in the alphabet. And if you knew that this was something was enciphered in ROT 13 at the other end, you'd just move it forward or move it backward 13 places. For 13, it doesn't matter with the alphabet, with 26 characters in the alphabet. And then you could read it. Now, much later on, something called asymmetrical encryption was developed. And this is a way of doing a key exchange, that is explaining what the method is of enciphering something, without having to have that first shared secret, that first bit of information. And we found out not so long ago that some of the groundbreaking research that was done on this was actually done by GCHQ. It was mathematicians and cryptographers there that developed this, kept it secret because they couldn't work out any application for it. Outside of that, separately, other people developed this further, stumbled upon it by themselves, and worked out how we could use it to ensure secure communications between people that had never previously been met. It's this kind of encryption that now our mobile phones rely on, our banks rely on, our computers rely on to authenticate and to securely transmit information.
What I'm struck by in reading Tom's book is how many parallels there are between why we and governments say that we need encryption beyond the, you know, the economic principles. You know, there are questions of national security. It's this idea that telegrams were regarded as less secure than letters, which, as of course we all know, you know, you can get letters from the post office, you can intercept them in that way. You know, governments had to come together in order to create these codecs, as it were, to have international agreements on how information was spread back and forth. Is this, so obviously we have things that we wish to keep secret, that we wish to keep away from prying eyes. Is there anything particularly new about how we do it now?
I mean, for a lot of the standards that we rely on now are developed in conjunction with governments, with industry, with academics. Increasingly, the idea that you'd have a specific kind of encryption that would be developed just for one application, is no longer the case. Now, the best way for something to be secure and for everyone to have trust in it is for everyone to develop it together, to test it together, to attack it together, to work out whether or not it has weaknesses. And if everyone at the end of that process says, no, I think this is solid, this is good, then people start saying, well, you know, we'll put our name behind it. And this is how standards bodies have been created between governments, between companies, between academic researchers, that have allowed us to have confidence and trust in that these systems work. One of the things that we've learned, thanks to Edward Snowden over the last year and a half, that some spy agencies have spotted this problem, that we all use the same kind of encryption for a large number of our transactions. And so what the NSA did, which is the American spy agency, is they tried to put a backdoor into these standards. They tried to artificially weaken it, allowing them to get in whenever they wanted, but also, of course, allowing any other actor who knew that same way to get in to also get access to that protected information.
Whenever I write about encryption, I often find it, I find myself resorting to saying you can't do it because it just doesn't work that way when talking about some concept. In most recently, of course, David Cameron's suggestion to just sort of demand that backdoors are put in that only can be opened by the government. And without going into too much detail, it's quite hard to explain why that's not the case. I wondered, you know, if you're speaking to someone who only knows about encryption from what they've heard right now, what are the things that make it unique, that are a bit, that don't work the way you would expect about it? What are sort of the three counterintuitive things that people should know about asymmetrical encryption as used on the internet today?
Well, for me, I think the best way to conceptualize it is kind of in one thing, which is that if you want something to be secure, nowadays you need that to be as secure as possible against any and all attackers. And that's because now, if something's weak and a way of breaking into a system is published, very quickly anyone who has access to the internet can find out about it. This means that kind of common criminals can get access to ways to break into machines that maybe a year or so ago might have been, dealt with in it with a kind of a very kind of secure system by a foreign intelligence agency. So to have security that works, it's got to work against everyone. What this means is that if you're the British government and you're trying to protect your own parliamentary emails or your own parliamentary systems, you're also trying to provide advice to British companies that are trying to keep Chinese attackers out. You've got to use encryption that is strong against everyone, even if that means it prevents you from getting access to it sometimes when you would like to get access to it. There's no way of doing a system that achieves both, that keeps other the bad guys out while allowing the good people in. It either works or it doesn't.
How can I encrypt the content of my emails, of my conversations? Because that's ultimately, you know, we've had people's digital signatures. We've talked a lot on this program about passwords and how to protect our online accounts. But here we're talking more about the content of our communications. So how can I, as a, you know, an everyday user, encrypt my stuff so that people can't see it?
Well, increasingly, companies offering webmail encrypt the one part of your email. That is, in the course of it being sent from your computer to their servers. And companies like Google Gmail now offers HTTPS, which is that kind of transport layer security, by default. You know, this is a fantastic move, something that was long overdue, but nevertheless, it's been adopted and many other companies are following suit. This is a really important thing. This is going to keep out a large number of attackers. If you want to take further steps, if you're a journalist or you're particularly concerned about sources, although I say that everyone should be concerned and everyone should be doing as much as they can to secure things, there's free tools that you can download from the internet called GPG. There's different variants for Windows and for Apple computers that you can follow instructions and begin encrypting your email in such a way that, in theory, no attacker should be able to read them.
One of the problems with that, though, Eric, is that it requires that people change their behavior, that they change their routines. And as we all know, that's very, very difficult to do. What will inspire people to change their routines and to encrypt their content?
Well, in the last year and a half, since Edward Snowden transferred some of his documents to journalists, I now have had more encrypted communications with more people from more walks of life than I have ever had before. Lawyers now regularly email me with encrypted communications. Journalists do so, I'd probably say, half of the time now, which is a phenomenal change. But you're right. It's an extra step, and we've all got things, you know, in our day that means this might fall further down the to-do list. For us, that's why it's so important that companies who are developing communications tools put the strongest possible security and encryption into their tools by default. More and more companies are doing this, and there's going to be a whole range of new companies launching projects in the wake of Edward Snowden. You know, over the last 6 months to a year, we get their press releases very, very regularly. A really important thing to understand about that, though, is that those companies to do that need to be allowed to do that. That means that there cannot be any legislation that prevents them from offering customers the kind of security that they need to secure themselves. This is what's been so concerning about some of David Cameron's speeches over the last couple of weeks, saying we need to limit or ban or end encryption. It's been a bit unclear about exactly where his kind of policy is targeted at, because this could have a really damaging effect on companies' ability to be able to offer us the kind of security that we need.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Aaron King from Privacy International.
Pleasure.
And thanks to you for joining us. That's all we have this week. We'll be back next week with more analysis of the week's biggest stories. Remember, for breaking tech and digital news, just go to theguardian.com/technology. For me, Alex Kwiatkowski, the team, Samuel Gibbs, Alex Hearn, and producer Jason Phipps over there in the box, we'll be back next week. Do join us.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.